409-590-WKZO. Raj Taylor and Michael taking you home this afternoon, but perhaps with a hitch in your travel plans. What's going on, Michael?
I got a traffic tip from a caller. Said there's accidents on eastbound I-94 near exits 85. Traffic is at a standstill. Alternate routes would be suggested.
Which direction's at a standstill?
Or eastbound.
Eastbound. Okay. What's the? I don't think by mileage. I don't think by numbers. Which exit are we talking about?
Exit 85 is near Galesburg.
Okay. That's more helpful to those of us with limited mental abilities. So thank you, sir. Joining us now is Rob Mize. He's from a Michigan-based organization, the Organization for Bat Conservation. And they do a lot of good work, not just here in Michigan, but worldwide. Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Bats have some problems these days. Wind turbines in some cases, but the biggie is nature causing a problem for them. It's called white nose syndrome. And are we seeing any signs of bats building resistance to the disease?
Well, I think that's a great question, and we've actually seen some interesting responses that bats have been having. Roger, the white nose syndrome is a fungal infection that we believe was accidentally introduced from Europe, roughly a little under 10 years ago. And it landed in a cave called Howe's Cave, was the very first place that we had seen it near Albany, New York, a really common tourist cave, and one of the visitors had noticed a lot of bats down on the ground, dead. And ever since then, so this was about 7 years ago. Ever since then, we've been monitoring it, and unfortunately, it's been spreading across North America. And currently, this fungus has spread from this one county to 25 states, 5 provinces in Canada, and well over 6 million bats have been documented to have perished.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Before we go any further, I've got two questions.
Sure.
One is, I had read an article suggesting that the fungus has been found in Great Britain, and yet the bats there seem to not be impacted. Do you have any insight into that?
Sure. And so the fungus actually doesn't kill the animal. It does cause, I'm sure, quite an irritant. The other thing is that it wakes the animal up during hibernation too many times. Mm-hmm. And so that's what actually ends up happening. So the bats wake up too many times when they're hibernating in caves and mines where this fungus has been introduced.
And they
now,
run out
bats
of...
that migrate aren't having that problem because they don't hibernate. The bats in England and other European countries have been found to have this fungus living on them but not dying. But some of the questions that we have are how comparable are their, like the longevity or the how long their hibernating period is.
Mm-hmm.
So possibly they only hibernate for 2 months. Our bats hibernate for 4 months or 5 months, and that fungus has a longer time to affect them, and then they end up waking up too early in the winter, and they end up starving.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess partially is that the raw changes or difference in hibernation is that reason. Now, we have seen in the Northeast some bat populations – very small bat populations have been either returning or colonizing some of these caves that have been affected for 6-7 years.
Mm. And they're not getting the white nose syndrome?
Well, they may actually be still have the fungus that grows on them, but not dying from it.
Okay.
I think it's obviously a more of a longer term monitoring program, but still the biggest effects are we're looking at some of these colonies that had tens of thousands of bats now having a couple hundred bats.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've even if we do have a couple hundred bats that are able to deal with the fungus, bats reproduce at such low rates, it'll take centuries to build the population back up.
Sure. Another question I have, I was looking at a map of the incidence of white nose syndrome, and while we see it predominantly to the east, there's also now many cases in Minnesota, Wisconsin. We seem to be in a donut hole. Why are Michigan bats not being impacted to date as much as bats in other states?
Yeah,
or am I looking at the map incorrectly?
No, you are. So that's true. So what you could also look at, and sometimes if you overlay where bats hibernate. Then we see the same map of where the bats being affected by white nose syndrome exists as well. So in most of Michigan, especially the lower peninsula, we don't have hibernacula. We don't have caves.
Right.
Or we have
mines.
Very few mines.
Yeah.
So we've got some mines in the upper peninsula, but there's that big jump. We've got a giant lake or giant lakes. And so I think that the fungus has taken longer. It's not in Michigan. It's actually, as far as I know, it's not in Wisconsin yet. It is throughout Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, over the last couple of years, as far west as Oklahoma, right, Minnesota. So, excuse me, we're seeing it spread, and farther south as well, Arkansas and South Carolina and stuff. And then we have some species that are in some of these southern states that have had the fungus growing on them for 3 or 4 years, but that are not dying from it at all.
Mm.
And again, I feel like one is it could be just that, you know, the length of hibernation in Connecticut is drastically different than the length of hibernation in South Carolina.
Right.
So that alone could do it. The other thing could be that we've got just slightly different humidity or temperature or whatever that the fungus doesn't have its hold like it does in some of these other areas.
Okay. We're talking with Rob Mize from the Organization for Bat Conservation. I've read that there's a couple of drugs that seem to be beneficial for the bats. One of them made by Pfizer right here in Kalamazoo. Have you read much about that? Have you seen these drugs been used successfully? And how do you use these drugs on a wild population?
Sure. So the drugs, do you know, Roger, offhand, were these an antifungal application?
Yeah, Diflucan is the one in particular.
Sure.
That's
you know,
Pfizer
what's
product.
What's been exciting for us to monitor and watch, currently I believe there are 4 laboratories in the United States, and there might be a couple in Canada as well, because Canada is being affected as well. But there are at least 4 major laboratories in the United States that are studying white nose syndrome, and a lot of what they do is study the fungus and what the fungus grows on and what doesn't it grow on. How can it be killed? Does it go dormant? How does – you know, so there's a lot of – the more we learn about the fungus, then we have possible applications.
Oh, sure.
Roger, there are a lot of antifungals that we could use. A lot of them. There's natural ones. There's even a bacteria that is a natural enemy of fungus. Mm-hmm. That could be introduced, or that it's a native species of bacteria that could also fight it off. What we don't want to do though is we don't want to go into a natural ecosystem like a cave and just use an antifungal, because then we could get rid of the natural fungus that could screw up an entire ecosystem just to save one species of animal.
Yeah. Yep.
So I think that's where we struggle right now, is that we do have, drugs and natural antifungals to fight it, but it's the application itself. And one of the more interesting things that I think we're going to see more of is the creation of artificial hibernacula. So concrete bunkers, almost like mines, you know, that we drill in and we can treat when the bats leave because we're not messing up an entire ecosystem like in a cave.
Okay. And are we looking at doing any of those things in Michigan, or are these still in the evaluation process?
Well, one was conducted in the Northeast sometime in the last couple of years. But not a lot of information has come out of that. Another one was built by the Nature Conservancy in Tennessee. This past winter was really the first winter that was kind of tested out as well. And there was a lot of struggling with trying to keep the humidity up, which is really important when bats are hibernating. You know, we're mammals. We need our moisture because we dry out and dehydrate before. And that's why bats go underground, and the humidity is really important. So we haven't seen them successful, but they've also been – there's only been a couple tried. And there are a lot of discussions, and I'm a big proponent, and I'm – look, you know, we've got a couple of locations that are willing to try it out, but obviously funding is a huge issue.
Sure. Rob, before I let you go, let's talk a little about the bat zone.
Sure.
There's a lot of prejudice out there against bats, most of that from a lack of understanding. And we don't have vampire bats in the United States. One way to deal with that is for people to learn more about bats. And so talk to us about the bat zone.
For sure. You know, we've been partnering with Cranbrook Institute of Science in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, so about a half hour north of Detroit, for the last roughly 12 years that we've been here. We're open to the public, and we have a rescue facility that cares for injured and orphaned bats. So a lot of these are actually exotic bats that had lived at zoos or museums or something and are of older age. We also have some native species bats that were found as babies or broken wings, and they couldn't be released. So we're a rescue facility, but what makes it really fun, and you know this, is to see live bats up close, really just helps people understand that these aren't the scary, slimy, you know, vicious animals that sometimes movies portray them as.
Oh, absolutely, and especially the fruit-eating bats who don't have the structure on their face for echolocation, they really do look like a flying dog or a flying fox. They don't even look threatening.
They make great poster bats.
Oh yeah,
they do. They, you know, they look like a dog or like a bear. You know, what's so important is that, you know, our 9 species of bats in Michigan all eat insects. And there was a report that came out a couple of years ago by scientists estimating that U.S. farmers benefit an average of about $34 billion annually from insect control that U.S. bats provide. So they're eating such large amounts of moths and beetles, which are huge agricultural crop pests. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been working with apple orchard growers in Michigan, putting up bat houses and trying to help control, you know, coddling moths and other detrimental insects. So
great.
That's the key. You know, our bats in Michigan, they eat tons of bugs. None of them eat fruit. None of them drink blood. So they're great to have around. You don't want them in your house. You know, put up a bathhouse to give them an alternative, but to have them in your backyard is perfect.
Yeah, and I read an article recently that suggested if we don't take care of our bird and bat populations, the next epidemic of things we're going to see are spiders.
Oh, sure.
That's nature's next layer of defense in controlling insect numbers.
Right. And, you know, that's interesting as well. And I think birds and bats have been thought about a lot recently for research. but not as much necessarily always for conservation. Yeah. You know, we do the bluebirds have really made a huge comeback. And I think that that shows us, though, that we can provide artificial roosting habitat like bat houses or even the artificial hibernacula I was talking about with mm-hmm. to fight white nose syndrome. Those things can happen. And if people understand the right dimensions and the right height and things like that to put up a bat house, it's a great way to help wildlife.
Yeah. And by the way, I do recommend your design for your bat house.
Great. Well, there's a lot of good ones now. You know, I've been working with bats for over 20 years, and I've consulted with a lot of companies, and slowly a lot of companies have made some changes to their bat houses. But you're right, though. If you want to put up a bluebird house, it needs to be the right, you know, dimensions.
Right.
You want to put up an owl box. If you want to put up a bat house, make sure you get the right dimensions. So, and you know, people can download those for free on our website. It's batconservation.org. And I did a video too, so people can use that to also help build their own bat houses.
Well, and it's more than just the dimensions of the box being right. Where you put it
absolutely
makes a great deal of difference. You can take a perfect design and put it in a place that nobody will ever use it.
Yeah.
And so there's more to it. And that's where your organization comes into the process. Rob, before I let you go, and we're running out of time, a listener called in and wants to know, is there any safe way to move a hibernating bat?
Yeah, you know, we do get a lot of questions when people find like a bat, like let's say in their garage or in their attic. You know, in the winter they go to pull down the Christmas tree or something,
right,
and there's a bat there. Typically, we tell them to leave it there, but obviously, if it can't be left there, then in nature they would be underneath a brush pile or something like that. So we say find a hollow log. Get underneath a brush pile, but they could also be brought to a local wildlife rehabilitator, a nature center that would be able to just care for the bat through the winter, and then the bat could be released in the spring.
Okay. I appreciate your taking time to talk with us this afternoon. I have found our conversation vaguely reassuring in that I'm not hearing this is an extinction-level event for bats, that we may find our way to help bats survive this problem.
I think so. I think there are two things about bats. One is that bats are smart and they will change their behavior. Two, if we provide them with the right habitat so that they can change their behavior, then they will survive this.
And Rob, what is the website for the Organization for Bat Conservation?
Sure, great, thank you. It's www.batconservation.org. And from that, click on bat houses or learn anything else. Come and visit us at the Bat Zone here at Cranbrook. We're open so people can come to it. Or even just check our upcoming events, because we do travel all over the state of Michigan, and we're often in your area.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks. A good one.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rob Mize from the Organization for Bat Conservation. Well, yesterday I posed the question to Josh Israel from Think Progress, and that was, can we in Michigan learn anything from the results of the election in Virginia earlier this week? And our discussion led us to both believe that we can. And as a result, I've invited Mark Schauer, the Democratic candidate for governor, to join us coming up in just a few minutes, and we'll find out if he thinks we can learn anything from the Virginia election results. Raj Taylor driving you home this afternoon. 43 degrees. Winds out of the west-southwest at 7, 8, 10 miles an hour. So there's a wind chill out there. But we didn't get the possible lake effect snow showers we were threatened with. So there's no complaining. This is a no complaining zone. Joining me now is the Democratic candidate for the governor's job, Mark Schauer. And invited Mark because yesterday had an interesting conversation with a reporter who covered the Virginia election and discussed whether there were lessons we in Michigan can learn from what took place in Virginia, and thought a good reality check for that would be Mark Schauer. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Great, Roger. How are you?
I'm good. Do you think there is an analogous situation between Michigan and Virginia?
I think there is, in a sense that Virginia is a battleground state, as is Michigan, although Virginia is much more of a swing state. I would characterize it as being much purpler than Michigan.
I mean,
Michigan is you'd characterize it as a light blue state. In the case of Virginia, a governor can only serve one four-year term. But the outgoing governor is a Republican. The Republican nominee was the Attorney General, so kind of the establishment Republican candidate, sort of a continuation of the current governor in office. And the Democrat that won had run before and lost. I think in many respects was viewed as kind of an underdog candidate. A lot of issues played out, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think the point is that, you know, this is a true battleground and in an off year, and the Democratic candidate won. The candidate represented the party that the president won. That hadn't happened in Virginia in something like 40 years.
Yeah.
And so I think it does bode well for Democrats in Michigan. It bodes well for my candidacy here.
Well, and the parallel that I see is it's a state who had its Senate and House districts gerrymandered to make sure conservatives won elections, and yet they didn't this time. And so that's, in my mind, similar to what we're facing in Michigan.
Well, I think that's right. I think, I think Virginia is as close to Washington, D.C. as you get. And there are many federal employees there. The government shutdown was felt by, you know, thousands, I'm sure tens of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. In communities and businesses in Virginia. So this was a state that could gave us, I think, the closest reaction by the voters to what's been going on by the Republican Party and by Republicans in Washington. And so I think it's a bad sign for the Republican Party. And, you know, Governor Snyder will try to distance himself from a Republican Party that, in this case, was thought it was a good idea to shut down the government to stop people from getting health care. You know, Governor Snyder here, he will try to run from it, but he is the head of the Republican Party in Michigan. And, you know, he's presided over a legislature, in essence, that has passed a number of provisions that I think John Engler only would have dreamt of. Things like a big corporate tax paid for by deep cuts in education and a pension tax. A passing right to work.
Oh, yeah.
Which will result in lower wages for people. And so it's a pretty extreme agenda that he's presided over and led here in Michigan.
Speaking of a radical agenda, let's talk about what's been going on in Lansing the last couple of days, and that is hobbling the state court system.
Right.
Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I do. In fact, I call on the governor to veto Senate Bill 652, which really is another pure political power grab. The Court of Claims has existed in, Ingham County. It's the home of, state government, Lansing being in Ingham County. And that's where when people sued the state government, that's where those claims, those cases were heard.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I think this does directly relate to Governor Snyder's Nerd Fund, because there's a pending lawsuit by an individual asking the courts to force the governor to reveal his secret corporate donors to his Nerd Fund, that now they're looking for a different place for this case and other cases like that to be heard. So I know that this is not about sound jurisprudence in Michigan. This is a case where the legislative branch and the executive branch are tampering with the judicial branch. So I think it's highly questionable whether this would be even constitutional. And it's, this is, again, Rick Snyder, not, the nerd non-politician that he ran as in 2010. This is a person who is engaged in politics as its worst.
Yeah. We're talking with Mark Schauer, the Democratic candidate for governor. Mark, try to explain to me in terms that I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but we call it the Court of Appeals. Doesn't that infer that things that go there are appeals of other court actions?
I think you're pretty smart. That's exactly right. It is an appellate court, and that's what it's there for. So, look, in Michigan, we've got a lot of things to fix, and I hope I can use my bully pulpit when I'm governor to do this. I mean, Supreme Court, we think of our courts as nonpartisan, right? Well, Supreme Court, well, it's because you're a student and you pay attention, but Supreme Court justices are nominated by political parties. The candidates are. And then they run on the ballot without a party designation. That's crazy and wrong, because the people deserve to know, are these folks nominated by a Democratic Party or Republican Party? They at least need to know.
Right.
Well, these appellate judges are the same way. And so there is a partisan flavor there. And, that's exactly what Rick Snyder is trying to do. He's got the legislature to do his bidding for him on this case. Again, I think trying to protect his special interest Nerd Fund donors. And he just wants to be able to judge shop and appoint a panel of judges that would be favorable when he needs it.
Mm-hmm. And you said that it's a questionable constitutionality. Where will that be tested? where do they go to the appeals court with it as if the law's in effect?
That's a good question. Ultimately, it would, if it made it that far, would make it to the Supreme Court, but you're right. These things are started at lower courts, like a circuit court.
Yeah.
And then, the next step would be the Court of Appeals. So I don't know how I think they've created this real interesting game here that, the reality is the public loses, the special interests win. I think that's wrong.
Yeah.
And that's why I urged the governor, to live up to his original campaign promises and stay away from these things that are secret, that are the opposite of transparency, and veto this. He was quoted as saying that this was, good legislation and this would be good for the public. I think it couldn't be further from the truth. So I hope he sleeps on it and vetoes this bill.
Yeah. Before I let you go, what does your gut tell you? Are we ever going to find out who funded Snyder's slush fund?
I think we will. I think it will not be done voluntarily. There may be donors that come forward on their own. Now, it's interesting, CVS Caremark is the only one that's, well, they were sort of outed, but they, I think, then came forward. They're an example of a company that contributed $1,000 to the NERD Fund. Rick Snyder was not willing to release it, but it became public. They just won a $60 million no-bid contract by Rick Snyder's emergency manager in Detroit to provide to do pharmacy benefit management for Detroit City employees. Not a bad return on investment. So I don't think Rick Snyder wants any more of these donors released. But I think it will ultimately happen, but it's not going to be done voluntarily.
Okay. And not only did the Kevin with a Y or let that no-bid contract, but the NERD Fund was paying for his $1,000 a month hotel room.
Right. Right. Well, it's actually $4,200 a month.
Well, that's right. It's $1,000 a week.
Yeah. Yeah. $4,200 a month for his luxury condo. That's three or four times more than what a Detroit City retiree earns in their pension, which, by the way, the same emergency manager, under the approval of Governor Snyder, is proposed to be cut. So, you know, all of these things are wrong. I just call on the governor to be transparent, as he promised. Be transparent and let the sun shine in. Sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, one last question. When you find yourself staying in the Detroit area, your job is to travel the state these days, do you stay in $1,000 a week suites?
I tell you, I went on hotels.com and found a small, just a regular hotel room. It was like $65 a night. It was the best. It was about the best I could do, you know. And I bumped up with one of my staff.
Yeah, like regular people.
I want to point out he's a male, by the way.
Oh, okay. That's for your wife's benefit, no doubt. Yes.
She approved. She was okay with that.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Mark. I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us this
Roger,
afternoon.
Roger, I look forward to doing it again.
You bet. Mark thanks, Schauer, bye. The Democratic candidate for the governor's office. And, yeah. I agree with him. We don't need to rearrange our court system in the state to suit the needs of our current governor. That's going to just about do it for Roger and Michael on a Thursday. I got some good news for you on the gas price front. The low price in the area remains in Richland at $3.17. And numerous stations along Gull Road at $3.19. And the $3.19 price is actually spreading. And we're seeing it along Sprinkle Road, a $3.15 on Portage Road, and $3.17 and $3.19 through downtown. And so the low prices from Richland appear to be spreading into the greater Kalamazoo community. Yeah, save yourself a couple of shekels when you fill up your gas tank. The WKZO.com AccuWeather forecast. Brisk and chilly tonight. Clouds and some sun. Rain or snow shower possible into this evening, though it appears we've missed most of that. Clouds and cold the rest of the night, 32 the low. Sun and clouds tomorrow, but still cold, 46 the high. Saturday, partly sunny, breezy, milder, and a high of 55. That'll give you a chance to go out and clean up the last of the fall leaves. I tried to do that this morning, except I got one darn tree that won't lose its leaves. I wanted to stand under it with my blower, but I couldn't get them to fall. I may try that tomorrow morning. Have yourself a good evening. We'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3.
This is Kalamazoo's news station and Kalamazoo's home for Detroit Tiger baseball. 590 WKZO Kalamazoo.